After the death of her 6-year-old daughter, Charlotte, Suki Forbes struggled to come to terms with grief as she worked against the emotional reserve and strict self-reliance that are part of her blue-blooded New England heritage. She explored her family's history of spiritual seekers, including her great-great-great-grandfather, Ralph Waldo Emerson, who similarly lost a young child, and later, through a renowned medium, made a connection with Charlotte on the other side. It is a moving story of coping with loss, finding reassurance, and recapturing the joy of living by accepting the gifts of suffering. Her new book is The Angel in My Pocket. It is a pleasure to welcome Suki Forbes to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure.
I'm so glad to join you. Thanks for having me.
At what point in this ordeal, tragedy, did you decide that you wanted to share this with an audience?
Well, it became very clear to me early on that I had only 3 choices about how to move forward in my grief and for the rest of life. And one was dying, one was existing, and one was living. And I wanted to die, and anyone who's lost a child will usually say that's what they would want as well. But I didn't get to. I had other surviving children. Existing seemed like a real possibility. But I wanted to believe that I would see my daughter again, and I wanted to make the time move more quickly between that time and when I saw her. And so living seemed like the only option. And so all I could do was choose to want to live and work towards that. And once I got to that decision, I looked very hard for resources that would give me hope and give me a lifeline and some sense that life could be better again. And I was really disappointed at every turn and frustrated. And then that sort of fed into the internal dialogue of, I'm doing this wrong. And I became frustrated and determined that if, in fact, one day I got to that place of fully embracing life again and was even possibly a better human being for having experienced the suffering, that I would share the path and share the story in hopes that my book would end up on someone else's nightstand and help them along the way, or would be a resource that outlined someone's story moving through.
Your daughter died of a rare genetic disorder, and you point out in the book that you were so numb that it actually took quite a while before you even hit a stage of grief.
That's true. I think that we all move through personal tragedies in different ways, and some people immediately get to that emotional space. I was raised a very old New England stoic culture where you pick yourself up by the bootstraps and keep moving. And I was utterly incapacitated by numbness because the idea of descending into such a scary abyss and coming unglued worked against every way I was raised to be. And so I really was in a state of complete numbness. I looked like a zombie walking around, and everybody else was weeping, and I just sort of walked around thinking, I was in some, you know, first of all, I was in crisis as if I'd lost a child in a park. Where is she? Where is she? Where is she? So part of it was just trying to figure out where my child was, and part of it was just my part nature, part nurture, inability to feel anything. And so the first part of my process was definitely focused on just learning how to feel anything.
You talk in the book about growing as a woman from the grief rather than staying mired in it. And that almost makes it sound like it's a conscious decision where you were there for a long time and say, okay, I have to get out of this place.
Well, that's interesting that you bring that up, because I do think that we have choices. And I think that being miserable is ultimately a choice. Now, I don't for a minute advocate avoiding the great suffering and anguish and all that goes with grief or any personal tragedy, whether it's a bad diagnosis or, we're all brought to our knees at some time or another. But we also get choices as to how we react to that in the long term and where we set our sights for where we're going to ultimately try to be. And I think that's a very important piece of it, is we can choose to stay in that misery. We're all going to be there at some point. It would be inappropriate to say that we are not suffering and struggling. But I do think that we can consciously decide to pull ourselves out at some point, and we all do it at different rates and in different ways.
There was also the fact that you had a husband and two other children, and you wanted to maintain the relationship with them as well, of course.
Absolutely. And initially, to be honest, my surviving children and my husband were the only reason that I could find to keep living. And the only tragedy worse than losing a child would be to have my two surviving children lose their entire childhood. And so they were really the impetus to keep my husband and me moving for a while. And there was a lot of faking it and just showing up, but we were there. And it was very important to keep them a part of the picture and active and as happy as could be, and also support them in their own personal struggle.
You explore this in the book, but that faking it and just showing up is important because it gets you back into a routine.
That's right. And I think that faking it is a part of any habit that we form, laying down those tracks in the brain. You have to go through the motions for a while, and you show up often enough that it starts to feel okay. And one day you find that, you know, you're taking that walk, and all of a sudden one day you see a flower blooming and it makes you smile. And I think that that is not unique to grief. I think it is really important for all of us to just keep showing up. And I do think that's a very important component in healing. That and showing up, sitting quietly and listening to what we need inside personally, what Emerson refers to as the still small voice, and then also equal parts of being very open-minded to other places that provide us comfort. And that gets into a whole nother conversation. You know, in The Angel in My Pocket, I found comfort in some pretty out there ways. But at the end of the day, what's important to each of us is that we find some space outside of ourselves that brings us comfort and distraction.
You just quoted Emerson. You have very impressive lineage that includes Ralph Waldo Emerson, which I mentioned in the introduction. Tell us a little bit about your ancestry.
Well, he in particular became a very important part of grieving for me for many reasons. I do come from a long line of old New Englanders that are very march boldly forward and are very connected to the divinity in ourselves and in nature. Again, that's a very Emersonian teaching. And when Charlotte died, because I didn't come from a particularly emotionally communicative family, I turned to family papers and letters. And Ralph Waldo Emerson obviously has much more out there than many people. And it was very quickly that I was reminded that not only did he lose a child, but he lost a child at the age of 6 to a high fever, just like my daughter Charlotte. So that was sort of bingo, this man is going to be very helpful in the process. And his writings and his teachings took on a whole new meaning for me. And that was really, really important. And he's pretty dense and hard to get one's arms around, but he was a very expansive thinker. And those early transcendentalists, I think, were riding the crest of this, the wave of a lot of this new thinking in terms of other dimensions and the collective consciousness and the oversoul. It's all it's very intriguing to me that they were so involved in that so early.
I find it fascinating because you did not look at Emerson in a way that many of us would, perhaps, where you say, I'm going to go to the bookstore and I'm going to get everything I can on Emerson and read this. You went at it very much through your family lineage, through your family ancestry of saying, okay, I'm going to look at these papers and go through it that way, to make it much more personal, of course.
Well, and I'm very experiential based. I'm not an academic by nature. I'm much more an experiencer of life. And so knowing that a family member such as he had been through this experience, again, reading, it's just as you said, reading about his writings and his inspiration that he had had walking along paths, that I walked the same paths that he did, or reading in family guest books poems that he had written, earlier that morning. That spoke to me so powerfully. Again, more as my great-great-great-grandfather imparting knowledge than as the great man that that he is in terms of the literary and the philosophical community. And that he was really a lifeline and a source of hope and inspiration for me, and continues to be.
So one of the ways that you attempted to reconnect with Charlotte was through mediums and clairvoyance. Mm-hmm. What led you down that road?
Well, I mentioned before that I do believe that making it through a personal crisis involves the tension between sitting quietly with ourselves and also looking outside of ourselves for other sources of comfort. I personally had to find out where my daughter was, and I was not raised with a lot of a religious architecture, and so I had to explore what I believed about what happens after we die. Is there a heaven? Where do we go? I was really open-minded to anything, and somebody suggested to me that I might want to go see a psychic medium, one of these people who has the ability to perceive energies or something, some essence of people on the quote-unquote other side or who have died. And I thought, oh my gosh, I'm willing to do anything if it will provide me some sense of where my daughter might be. And if she's out there, gosh, I want to talk to her. And I went in very, very skeptical, but open-minded. And for me personally, I was utterly blown away, and beyond any reasonable doubt, it was confirmed to me that some essence of my daughter was both separate and present still, and that to me was the missing piece in the puzzle that allowed me to keep moving forward, knowing that some essence of what she was still there, and that I could communicate with her in some way here, and that we would then be together later in whatever that afterlife was. And that was the key piece for me, and it came through very powerfully through a medium. And I was concerned in writing The Angel in My Pocket that many people would think, oh, she's just talking all kinds of crazy. But I will tell you that every time I share this book with somebody, I am approached from the audience by numerous people who share their stories and who will say, thank you for writing about this. I thought I was crazy, or let me share this story with you. So I am not saying it is the only answer, but it was a powerful source of healing for me. And I do think that we need to explore whatever avenues can bring us comfort in our darkest times and be open-minded to them.
So one of the things I found fascinating is that Ralph Waldo Emerson's wife, Lydian Jackson Emerson, had clairvoyant abilities. So that is also an entree here, an entry into what you are going to explore. And also, we should add to this, as you point out in the book, the woman's also a morphine addict. So, there had to be some balancing there of, okay, well, how much am I going to go into this?
Right. You know, so interesting, in all of the conversations I've had about this book, and that one line about the morphine addiction, I thought was going to get me in all sorts of trouble. You may have just gotten me in all sorts of trouble. We'll see how people respond. But nobody's asked me about that. And I find it really extraordinary that she did have these psychic abilities. I'm not saying on a regular day that she was walking around. And, you know, clairvoyances and parlor seances were very much sort of in vogue during that time period. But she had visions of the future and she saw other things. She definitely had an ability. And it has been said that Emerson had some of that ability as well. And I do believe, actually, many of us have it and can cultivate it to some degree. But it is interesting to me that she did have that. And then I do think the morphine addiction was not related. That was more, I think it was very difficult to be a woman in the 19th century, particularly when you were married to Emerson. I mean, I think she had a tough go of it. And morphine was the pharmacological comfort of choice at that time.
Mm. Was there also a feeling that this perhaps is genetic, in the sense that you were able to do this, and that the communication came as a result of this lineage and this family history?
Well, I think it is really presumptuous of me to say yes to that question, and yet I have questioned that myself a number of times. So I don't know the answer to that.
Why is it presumptuous?
Well,
I mean, it seems to me like you would just be saying, look, this is something that we have a shared commonality. And whether it was that or an ingrown toenail, I would think you would eventually look at it and say, this is something that maybe is genetic.
Well, maybe it is. It's six generations past. He's my great-great-great-grandfather. I think many of us identify with Emerson's philosophies and his writings. And so I don't by any measure mean to claim that I am the only recipient or beneficiary of any of that wisdom or DNA. But sure, the possibility does exist that some of that was transmitted to me, and certainly I'll take it. I do believe that in terms of the way in which I was raised, it was very Emersonian in terms of the reverence of God in nature. I mean, I love to be in a church, but I also feel closest to God and what really makes sense and the divinity and awe in the natural world. And I do believe that was transmitted directly from Emerson right down the line of tradition in the family, which is an enormous gift. Again, the natural world has been and continues to be a great place of healing and of sourcing energy and momentum and ideas. And I think it's a place where life and death makes the most sense, is in the natural world.
So how would you characterize your relationship with Charlotte now?
I think of her as, I have two relationships with Charlotte. I have one that lives mostly inside my heart, which is the grieving mother who didn't get to share the life with her child. All of those milestones, I didn't get to watch her grow up. And I ache for that at her birthday and all of the holidays. They're fraught. However, on a higher level, I think of her as a wisdom being or an angel. She's part of the reason for the title, The Angel in My Pocket, is that I feel that some essence of who she is around. And when I need comfort or counsel or prayers of thanks are often to her. I view her as on a higher level and as, again, some sort of a wisdom being. And I know that I will see her again, and that's important. But so I view her as more of a spiritual guide or an angel at this point.
So we come full circle. I began the conversation by asking you, at what point did you want to share this story with an audience? Mm-hmm. So now that it is done and you have gone through a word that I hate, but I can't come up with a better one right now, journey, mm-hmm. What do you hope people get out of the book?
I hope that people will walk away from the book with two, maybe three concrete ways of thinking or moving through a personal struggle that help them. And my ways may not work personally for other people, but I hope that by showing what I did in terms of sitting quietly and also being open-minded, hopefully people will take those, will try them, and will find their own sources of comfort, and will choose also and be recognize that at every turn choices need to be made, and that we can and will someday be not just okay, but be better for the experience. And in some ways that feels, every time I say it, it feels almost icky. Like, how could you be okay after the loss of a child? And yet we are made better by all of our experiences. And the whole, Nietzsche, that which does not kill me makes me stronger. It's really important to think about that. And I remember early on, my husband said to me, said, everyone keeps saying so-and-so lost a child and they were never the same. And I just had the sense I would be an attenuated version of the person that I was before, but never okay. And he's the one who turned to me and he said, well, just decide to be better. And I do think that we can be better from our experience if we let ourselves and give ourselves permission. And that bit I felt missing on the bookshelf, a real story of someone who decided to be okay, made it their mission, and then got there. And the journey and the decisions made along the way are highly personal, but I do think that from reading the book, people will get a sense of not only the full trajectory, because I didn't write the book until I knew I had arrived at that place, but also perhaps some helpful hints about ways in which they may want to move and consider.
Suki Forbes's new book is The Angel in My Pocket. It is published by Penguin. You can find out more information about her and the book by going to the website sukiforbes.com. Sukiforbes.com. Suki, thank you so much for sharing and being with us. I greatly appreciate it.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you very much. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.